You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the last few decades, the ecstatic celebrity mothers that we read about in magazines like People have been getting older. In fact, judging from the headlines, it seems women can now wait into the late 40s and even early 50s to get pregnant. But before you think that it's always just a piece of cake, you might want to read Miriam Zoll's new memoir called Cracked Open, Liberty, Fertility, and the Pursuit of High-Tech Babies. In it, she describes the 6 years she spent trying treatment after treatment to get pregnant through the fast-growing fertility industry. It's published by Interlink Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Miriam Zoll to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Had you thought about becoming pregnant before you turned 40?
I had thought about it off and on, but as I write about in my book, I had some childhood experiences that made me think that I would not necessarily want to create a nuclear family of my own all over again.
We're not going to go into detail about that.
No.
What about your husband? Had he wanted to have kids?
Yes, he did. He did. And we were very open about our conversations about it. And I, even prior to our wedding, I said, if you really, really want to be a dad, I'm not so sure I would be the best wife for you because I'm still very, very ambivalent about having children.
So did something shift when you turned 40?
My mother had birthed me when she was 39 years old. So I had also had a number of friends in my circle who had birthed babies at 39, 40, and 41, and that to me seemed like the end of my viable fertility window. And I came to learn the hard way that, in fact, many women's fertility declines rapidly at 35, and by the time I turned 40, I had a very, very difficult time becoming pregnant naturally, which is why I ended up turning to fertility treatments.
Aside from your age, was there anything to indicate that you might have trouble conceiving and carrying a baby to term?
I did end up, during the year that we started trying naturally, I was diagnosed with having endometriosis, and I had surgery to remove it from my ovaries. I had endometrial cysts. And I learned at that time that endometriosis is an inhibitor to pregnancy, and I had never had any other issues prior to that.
Now, that's a condition in which the endometrian wall comes off during menstruation in much, more cells are released than in normal menstruation?
In my case, it's that the endometrial cells grow outside the lining of the uterus, and they landed on my ovaries and created cysts. So it's when the endometrial cells grow outside of the uterine lining.
With that in mind, when you started, what did your doctors tell you about your chances of having a baby?
During our first meeting with a reproductive endocrinologist, he told us that our chances of conceiving were very low because of my age. However, he did not stop there in the sense that he did say, but you never know, it only takes one good egg to make a baby. And I believe that the doctor was wearing both his medical hat by being informative and telling us that our chances were low, but he was also trying to encourage us to try. And we decided to roll the dice with him.
Well, it is in their best interest to have you try, isn't it?
From a business perspective,
yes.
It certainly is. From a medical perspective, I think it's in the best interest of the patients to have a very candid and open and transparent conversation with the doctors. And our doctor was transparent with us, but then, unfortunately, I believe that he was more interested in his business opportunities, and he persuaded us to go forward with IVF treatments, which ended up failing in our case. In other people's cases, they do succeed. But from a global and national perspective, IVF fails 77% of the time globally and about 70% of the time annually in the United States, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control.
You write that your career really started to take off in your 30s, but fertility specialists are advising women to start having children earlier. One said that women should be done childbearing by the age of 35. So despite the advances in fertility medicine in the last 40 years, are women still being forced to choose between focusing on having children and focusing on their careers?
You know, unfortunately, that is the framework around this discussion that is a remnant of an old way of thinking about it, because the reality is the opportunities and the advantages that have been afforded to young women as a result of the U.S. women's movement has rendered a vast majority of working women to also want to be working mothers. And the workplace is now full of mostly working fathers and mothers, but the workplace scenario is still in kind of leaning in favor of the old model, which was a model that was suitable to a working father who had a wife at home to take care of the kids. But now you've got working mothers and fathers in the workplace, and it's time, in my opinion, to resurrect and restructure how the workplace works so that women like myself and millions of others around the country and the world don't feel that their only option is delaying the safe window of childbearing and attempting unproven and often experimental IVF and other assisted reproductive technology treatments, or foregoing their career and having children and being derailed from their professional aspirations. It's time that we all begin to work together to acknowledge and bring the sociological and economic roots to the workplace in a way that represents this pro-family values that we hear every 4 years from presidential candidates. Where are the pro-family workplace policies? Where is the paid maternal leave and the paid paternal leave? Where is the pay equity for women so that they don't have to work such long hours? It's all jumbled into this big mess, and unfortunately, in my opinion, as I say in the book, I think that women's bodies and their reproductive capacities are the new battleground around this.
Do you see any irony in the fact that you're one of the founding producers of Take Our Daughters to Work Day? That
yes.
was before you had a child.
It was before I had a child, yes. And the last thing on my mind when I was helping to produce that program was having children. It was not a program that was talking about balancing the workplace. It was specifically a program that was trying to focus attention on adolescent girls and their emotional needs at that time. And it also did segue into workplace and gender equity policies. But yes, there is definitely some irony there, and thanks for picking up on that.
Now, you pointed out the low success rate for in vitro treatments. What about some of the other treatments that the fertility industry has been offering? The success rate there is about one third as well, isn't it?
Well, with the new egg freezing technology, which has a number of panicked women running to fertility clinics to freeze their eggs, there was a new patient meta-analysis that I was just looking at a few weeks ago that indicates that with the flash freezing technique, about 77%, there's a 77% chance of success with a woman who's 30. I'm sorry, there's a 77% failure rate with women who are 30. And for women who are older, in around 40, say, there's a 91% failure rate.
Are live births the way the fertility industry defines success?
Excuse me?
Are live births the way that the fertility industry defines success?
Well, you know, it varies from country to country. In the United States, it's quite unclear how the success rates are calculated. From what I have researched and understood from the data available on the Centers for Disease Control, success does mean a live birth. In Britain, however, a success is considered a pregnancy, not necessarily a live birth. So it varies. There's no globally agreed upon definition of what of reproductive technology success means.
Miriam Zoll's writing has been published by the United Nations, the Earth Institute at Columbia University, the Christian Science Monitor, the Boston Globe. Her memoir, Cracked Open, Liberty, Fertility, and the Pursuit of High-Tech Babies, is published by Interlink. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Miriam Zoll, Z-O-L-L. Her memoir, Cracked Open, Liberty, Fertility, and the Pursuit of High-Tech Babies, is published by Interlink. What did the doctors say with each failed cycle of in vitro fertilization?
The generic response was there's another drug protocol that might be more effective for you. We're constantly finding new techniques that improve the success rates. Your other options are adoption, egg donation, or a life with no children. And my husband and I had grown up with some reverence for science. I myself had seen science save the life of three of my immediate family members who suffered from cancer. So I was very gung-ho and very optimistic about the science initially.
What about the expense?
We had insurance coverage for some of the treatments, and when the insurance coverage stopped, we dug into our own pockets. There are roughly only 15 states throughout the United States that do cover some form of fertility treatment.
As you moved through the cycles of in vitro, were you meeting other couples who had as much trouble as you and Michael were having in conceiving? Did they, what were they telling you?
We did know one other couple that was going through treatments, and they had experienced miscarriages. When I started treatments, we didn't know anybody who had had any negative encounters with the industry. And everybody in our circle, from healthcare providers to colleagues and friends and family members, we all believe that you go to the clinic and after the first attempt, you become pregnant with a healthy baby. So my circles were not full of cautionary red flags. And apart from that one couple that we met once we were in our own process of treatments, I then started to meet more and more women who had gone through treatments, including a colleague at Columbia University who had gone through 18 failed cycles. And when I met her, she was in the adoption process.
How much standardization of treatments and regulation of the fertility industry is there? Have some states in the U.S. tried to regulate the industry?
There have been some aspects of the industry that some states have regulated in the sense that in Louisiana, for example, single women and lesbian women are not allowed to access IVF. So there are many human rights and access issues at stake there. With regard to national regulation, there's only one piece of legislation. It's called the Fertility Clinic Success Rate Certification Act. And that was created in 1992. And it requires clinics to report only their success rates to the Centers for Disease Control. But it is not a mandatory legislation in the sense that there are a number of clinics that do not report their rates, and there's no penalty for not reporting.
Despite the fact that this can be risky medicine, and billions of dollars are spent on it each year.
Yes, it is risky medicine. After I completed my treatments, I was very fortunate to be invited to join the board of Our Bodies Ourselves, which is one of the preeminent women's health organizations in the world. And its tradition is to equip women with information so that they understand their reproductive health and they understand risks that may be involved in treatments or medical interventions that they may undergo. It was through my involvement with Our Bodies Ourselves that I learned about the risks that I actually had put myself through that I was unaware of when I was going through treatments, and that includes the hormones that I was injecting into my body, some of which have been linked to cancers, ovarian, endometrial, and breast in particular. In addition, I learned that Lupron, for example, is a very popular drug that's prescribed for women going through fertility treatments. It has not been approved by the FDA for that particular use. It is a prostate cancer chemotherapy drug. Hmm. So it's very interesting, and many people, when I talk about this, they say, oh, but that's just medicine in the United States. You know, doctors are always improvising, and they're always trying to figure out what may help. But the fact is that the absence of any proven risk doesn't mean that the risk doesn't exist. There haven't been enough long-term studies to track the health of women undergoing treatments or the babies born from them.
Is it different in other countries?
It is a bit different in countries that have nationalized health care because the government is paying the bill, and so they are doing a bit more tracking, for example, in Britain. But I think in general, this is an area of very under-researched study, and there needs to be much more going on. With regard to the children born from these technologies, there have been two comprehensive studies tracking the health of IVF babies, one in Australia last year and another one at UCLA. Both of them found an average of 25% associated risk of birth defects in IVF babies, primarily of the eyes, heart, and urogenital tract. So, again, this is another opportunity for more long-term funded research. And around the issues of babies, again, in Britain, the government is perched to or has already agreed to allow the reproductive technology industry over there to create babies from three sets of DNAs to help avoid a mitochondrial birth defect. And it's been highly contested among bioethicists and women's health providers. And Britain has a reputation for being a pioneer in reproductive technology. It was in Britain where the first IVF baby, Louise Brown, was born in 1978.
I would imagine that all these years of trying to conceive put a strain on your relationship with Michael, your husband.
Oh, yes, it did.
What about work? Well, tell me about Michael, but also I'm wondering about whether you were able to focus on your work the same way that you had before you started trying to get pregnant.
No. These treatments took over my life, and it put a huge strain on my marriage. And there are a number of people that my husband and I have met as we were going through treatments whose relationships could not be sustained through the trauma and the stress and the strain of these treatments. Miscarriage, stillbirth, negative pregnancy tests over and over and over again are extremely debilitating individually and for a couple's foundation, and they occur way more frequently than most people understand. With regard to work, when I was almost finished with my treatments, I had probably been involved with them by year five, I was really losing my ability to even have physical energy to do the work that I was doing, and I was commuting back and forth between Western Massachusetts and New York City. And I was overwhelmed with depression. I had very, very low energy. I was having a lot of mood swings from the hormone treatments. And I was full of regret that I had believed that it was safe for me to delay childbearing. And I was just very angry at myself for having lost the opportunity to birth a biological baby.
There was a rather small study, just 150 infertile people, that showed that over a third of them met the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder after going through these experiences. That is a small study, so I'm not sure we can really trust it. But did you feel like you had PTSD at the end?
Oh, absolutely. To the point where I ended up having treatment specifically for PTSD with one of the pioneer leaders of a treatment called EMDR, which is it's a somatic, which means body. It's a body-mind treatment, which allows the person to interrupt the nervous system's anxiety response or trigger response of fight or flight, which I had almost perpetually 24/7 for about 6 months. I was just all wound up, and everything was short-circuiting from a physiological as well as emotional perspective. And after two treatments with this particular person, I felt like I had a new lease on life. And my husband turned to me one morning and was startled to see me actually smiling. And so we're big endorsers of EMDR, and I also practice yoga, which was also a huge lifeline for me during my treatments.
Wasn't Michael kind of opposed to the idea of adoption? What changed his mind?
Michael was very intent on trying to have a biological child, and we did turn towards adoption after our sixth attempt with science to help us create a baby in the laboratory. And there was one particular meeting with the adoptive parenting group where a very small baby had come in to visit us, and it had eye contact with Michael for about 15 minutes, and he was smitten. And I think he had trepidation about being able to love a child that wasn't necessarily blood connected to him, but his love for our son is boundless, and we have both encountered the spiritual and sacred path of parenting through adoption, which is really a beautiful path.
Although that can be difficult as well. I just want to get back to the in vitro for a moment in the few minutes that we have left. You got pregnant from your third cycle of in vitro fertilization, then miscarried, and then you started to consider using an egg donor. Your two egg donors were later deemed infertile by doctors. Why hadn't that been caught earlier? Isn't there a screening process?
There is no screening process that requires the donor egg agencies to provide healthy donors to the prospective parents. The prospective parents, at least in Massachusetts, are required to pay for any type of psychological or physiological screenings. And our first donor's genetic disorder that has rendered her infertile was detected as a result of our paying for her tests. The second donor had been working with a group of parents at a different clinic and had helped one couple become pregnant. We never knew if that resulted in a live birth. But she was given very potent egg-stimulating hormones during her cycle with us, and they did retrieve 12 eggs, but none of them fertilized with my husband's sperm. And the doctor told us the day before I was scheduled to go in to have embryos inserted into my womb, he called to tell us the bad news. And in the same breath, he also said, "I hope this doesn't discourage you from trying again. You're a perfect candidate for donor eggs."
Ma'am, just one more thing. Like most stories about fertility, this is a very personal one. Did you hesitate to write this memoir?
Yes, I did, and I put it on the shelf many times. I cried during the entire process of writing this, and my husband thought I was torturing myself and re-traumatizing myself with every draft. However, it is a personal story, but I am also a women's health and reproductive rights advocate, and I really believe strongly that there is a large gap of information about the realities of what these treatments do to couples who go through them, and I also think there's a missing piece of discussion in the public domain about the ramification that these assisted reproductive technologies have on society at large, particularly around the areas of the commodification of women's bodies and their organs, in particular egg donation, which California right now is embroiled in a huge debate about whether to legalize commercialized egg vending. And then there's also an expanding surrogacy business in India, where you have upwards of 25,000 surrogates a year carrying children for wealthier couples from the U.S. and Europe. And there are some human rights concerns around that process and that growing business as well.
Ma'am, Zoll's book, Cracked Open, Liberty, Fertility, and the Pursuit of High-Tech Babies, is from Interlink Publishing. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.